say something about the thank everybody for the how the boat giveaway went. It went great or whatever.
We will.
I just hate to come back and beat people up and send another video or another post because we used it up. So, but I want to make sure people know that.
Can you figure out that voice in the background? It's pretty distinguishing. It's pretty easy. Hey, you know what? We are excited to do another one of these. You're listening to Inside Bassmaster, a podcast produced straight from the plush studios high atop the Twin Bassmaster Towers overlooking beautiful downtown Birmingham, the Magic City. This is your host, Thomas Allen. My co-host today is the man that keeps his finger on master control at Bassmaster.com, Mr. Jim Sexton, and in studio, our special guest. Bassmaster Classic Champion from 2014, nailed it, Randy Howell. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be here, man. Yeah. And in 2014, it seems like a long time now because you couldn't hardly remember it, so it's time to do it again.
That's right. And you're going to have your shot coming up in March. So
that's right.
We've got a ton of cool stuff to talk about, and we're going to start this off kind of looking back at your 2017 season. Jim has become a statistic monster. He's been crunching numbers and has a lot of cool questions, and it's probably going to throw you off your game a little bit, but so we're going to dig into that first. 2017, Jim, you got?
I'm ready to bring it, Randy.
Come on, man. I love numbers.
There might be a couple numbers in here you're not even aware of. So
I bet there are.
But we'll try it. But let's start out by talking about your 2017 season. You finished 28th in Angler of the Year points. You had a good year. And I'm just going to go through your finishes for the year, and you can sort of talk a little bit about your through line for the year, where you had some highs and lows, where maybe you struggled and felt really good about the season. Started out at Cherokee in 73rd place, finished that one in 73rd, moved to Okeechobee and finished 57th. Classic, really not thinking of it as much a part of the season, but you finished 46th there. Then Toledo Bend, he finished 11th, made the 12 cut, had a strong tournament.
Turned it around.
yeah, that's right. Ross Barnett, 30th place, Rayburn, 20th, Dardanelle, 25th, St. Lawrence, 64, Champlain, 67, St. Clair, 47, and then at Mille Lacs, Angler of the Year tournament, finished 36th. So, ultimately, you know, probably not as high as you wanted to finish, but you're clearly in the Classic, no sweating it out too much there, and, you know, you got to feel good about 28th place. But characterize your season for us. How'd you feel about it?
Kind of to, if you listen to those numbers, you kind of, in a nutshell, that's the proof right there that if you don't have bombs on the Elite Series and you just stay consistent, you can still make the Classic, and it doesn't look like you can when you start out. Like I started out with that 73rd, and then that 6th. It was a very disappointing start because it was different. It was the first year we've ever started before the Classic, and I never felt like I was ready to go yet. It was such a scramble during boat shows, and my boat from Triton was backed up. I didn't get my boat rigged in time. I was actually breaking it in at Cherokee. And none of that's an excuse. It's just simply I like preparation, and I like to be solid and lined up and have all my ducks in a row so I can do nothing but focus on trying to find fish. And it's so intense now with the competition being so good, you really don't need to be, you know, scattered in your mind trying to figure out what's going on when you get there. So, and I actually went to Cherokee back in the winter and scouted some and had a friend there that really, you know, taught me what that little deep water doodling rig deal was. And so I was prepared. Mm-hmm. I found a lot of fish there, and then I found the same fish that a lot of other people found, and I just wasn't patient and didn't wait to fish out long enough. So it was disappointing to have a 73rd, but I thought, well, we're going to Okeechobee. I always do good in Florida. I love Okeechobee. And, you know, and I get down there and I have a good practice and, you know, and have a bed fishing, sight fishing, have a good first day. And then the second day I couldn't catch a big one. And then right before I come in, I hook a solid 6-pounder on braid on a big diver, you know, Ishman Rose flipping stick, and I hook him on a long cast with a speed worm, and I'm winching him to the boat and big braid, and I'm not, and you know, you look, you swing fish out of that grass when you got a flipping stick and big braid, and I never have any problem. And all the years of doing it, I can't hardly remember losing one like that. And right as I'm getting it to the boat, it's coming real hot and it starts to make a jump. And that was that moment where you got to decide, go down, mash your button, and try to fight him a little bit or bring him in the boat right as he's jumping, and it all happens so quick. And I, right as I'm starting to swing him, I see the hook is right on the edge of his lip, and he tore off, and he hit the gunwale and went back in. It was a solid six and a half.
All in slow-mo, so you'll never forget it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the most sick mistake, you know, bad feeling I've had in so long, and it made a huge difference because I had like an eight and a half pound limit maybe that day, small buck limit. That would have given me like 14 plus. I'd have been in the deep 20s, low 30s, and fished another day with a chance to move up but not move down below 50. So, you know, that was just kind of what started it out. And then I think I took some of that negative momentum right into the Classic and didn't get anything going at the Classic. Had a disappointing finish there. But so then, like you say, getting to the Lita Bend, got back, got my head straight, had all my everything ready, you know, and I had a decent practice out there, and I had a jerkbait, Livingston jerkbait pattern going, was catching some good ones on that, and I was sight fishing and Cinco fishing and felt good about that. I made a top 12 cut. I didn't really have any chances there to advance much higher, so I felt good about that, no losses. And then Ross Barnett had a good frog pattern going there. That was one that I feel like I could have made a 12 cut. I had some opportunities there that just didn't happen. But I think I maximized what I had in that event and was happy that I turned it around. And I started seeing the fruits of the labor. You see how quickly you can move back up because I was sitting in the 70s after those first two. And if you ever focus on the downside, you can spiral out. Yeah. And you see that happen to a lot of anglers, and that's something over the years of just doing it for so long, I've learned that that's the bit. You can't focus on the negative or the downside. You got to take it one at a time, and if you have a bad one, you got to put it behind you, and you got to look forward and don't think about it again. And it's so hard to do that. Mm-hmm. But everything.
You had a nice stretch there where you went Toledo Bend 11th place, Barnett 30th, Rayburn 20th, Dardanelle 25th. So you had four tournaments in a row, boom, 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 strong tournaments.
And that was before we went north, right?
That's right.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. It was. And that the Rayburn and Bass Fest was another awesome one. You guys were covering me there some, and you saw the jerkbait pattern, mm-hmm. and like one of the best photography pictures I've ever seen on Bassmaster.com. I have to brag on Thomas over here. He had the jerkbait pictures. Nice. You know, I was holding that fish up. Looked like I had it by the belly and was looking at it in the face like, mm-hmm. thank you so much for biting my jerkbait and not getting
that
off. And that was a good picture, good photo gallery. And I had a frog pattern, that 1-2 punch. I really thought that was one I felt like, no doubt, a top five. I was going to get a top five. And when I fell out that last day, it just bugs you so bad. As long as I've been doing this, because I've done this a lot. I mean, I've been in the cut, in the top 10 a lot on the second day, and then the third day fall out, you know. And I never understand how, even though I try to figure it out, but it's typically because fish run out and you've got to make adjustments to keep something going, and I just didn't do it good enough. And I had fish, man, and when it really killed me, because I watched Bassmaster Live the next morning, and Brent Ayler was fishing right where that whole area. I had every one of them little grass places marked that I caught fish on them in practice, and I never went back below the bridge that direction at all. When I watched his map go right in there, and I thought, because I had two times I had that feeling in my gut on that day I was falling apart. I said I should run from the river, even though it was rough, run on that bridge and go down there, but I didn't know if anybody was in it or not, but it was such a big area, I could have still got down there and caught him on a jerkbait. Cherry was down there too, and it disappointed me that I messed up there. But then, what was Dardanelle after that?
Dardanelle 25th, and then the Northern Swing. And yeah. I think of you doing well up north.
I know.
I don't know if that's accurate or not.
It is.
I remember Oneida, and you lead in there and having a very close second at that event.
Yeah, and I won the open in 15 there at Oneida.
Right.
And so I love Northern and Smallmouth and both of those places. But I went to those, and if you look at it, the bad thing there, I can't see anything that you can say you messed up because you didn't do this. I just simply didn't catch 4 pounders. I caught 3.5 pounders and 3 pounders. I mean, I had stinking 32 pounds in both.
And the
of
days of catching 3 pound smallmouth, it doesn't work
anymore.
That's
a bad tournament, yeah. You know, and it was disappointing because I really thought I could catch enough four and a halfs mixed in. And the one day I 15 something and then 17 something was what I had to catch both days. And then the other one, the Champlain one, was disappointing. I had a breakdown in Champlain that really cost me there. I had a prop blade fly off on the second morning after I had that 18 the first day. And by the time then my motor messed up because it vibrated so bad after I changed the prop. So Robin pulled me out, and it was bad. I had to go get gas, putting the boat back in. Mm-hmm. By the time I ran back to Miss Siskoy, it was 9:30 in the morning, and the early bite was over, and I never recovered. I caught 12-pound limit, and that was what happened there. But it's disappointing not to catch a big enough fish in the north because, you know, and then I go to St. Clair. And I run to Erie. I didn't want to, but I ran to Erie because I felt more comfortable with the rock fish instead of the flats on St. Clair. And I go over there and had great days to get there, caught them. I was in 19th, you know, and then the third day, it got slick. Yep. Erie calm is Erie. That's what the name Erie comes from. If you see it on a day like that, it's Erie because it has that hazy slickness to it. And on the Lowrance, you can see the smallmouth sitting at 6 to 7 feet deep, just kind of swimming around like a Bass Pro Aquarium. And I couldn't, even on the spy bait, I caught a couple big ones on it the day before, and then I couldn't catch anything that day. And before you know it, I've got 2 hours left on that long run, and now I'm scrambling. I got 3 fish, and I'm thinking, should I salvage and run back, hit a few docks in the river, and salvage my points, or do I stay out here and keep swinging for the fence for the top 12 cut because I was right there? It could have gone either way.
Yeah.
And I bailed out and went in, and I didn't catch any more at all, and caught 3 fish and that 10 pounds, and that's like zero. And thankfully, I couldn't fall out of top 50 that day because it would have been really bad if you'd had 100 guys in it that day and I'd have caught 10 pounds. I'd have bombed, you know. So, I'm thankful for 28 for the year for sure, making a classic. But you look back and you see how easily you could have contended for Angler of the Year, you know. Mm-hmm. And it seems so easy over here, but yet it's so hard when you do it.
Right. A couple of decisions probably throughout your whole season.
Yeah, and it's like that every year. It's like that with everybody, and that's why. But at least you can still look back and see all that and know that I still am in the classic. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you're not first. As long as you're in the classic, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah. In terms of making the classic, you're a guy who has consistently made the classic. Looks like you've made 15 before next year. I think next year will be 16.
16, yeah, that's right.
So you've made 15, so, well, 16 we can say. And out of the 12 elite seasons, I went back and looked at your AOI finishes for those 12 years. And your average finish for 12 years is 23.75.
Huh.
So
23 point, top 25%. My wife always said I was a top 25%er.
Yeah.
So does that mean she's got low standards, or you do?
No, she didn't say that. I'm messing.
So that's an average of 24%, or 20, not percent, but an finish. Average finish of 24, which is strong. Your best finishes in AOI. In 2012, you finished fifth. In 2009, you finished sixth. 2008, you finished eighth. So three top tens in there and a couple that are really close, a 12 in 2006, a 13 in 2011. So out of those 15, how many have you made in a row, Randy?
I think the last one I missed was in New Orleans. Was that 2011 that Van Damme won? 11?
10? It was 10.
Okay. It was 10? I thought Lay Lake was 10.
Lay Lake was 10.
No,
yeah,
it was 11.
It was 11. That's
I
thought. So I made 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. I've made 6 this month, and then 18, so 7 in a row now.
Yeah.
That's I'm very, very thankful for that because it's been a lot of times in these last 7 years that it looked like, you know, I'm right on the verge of it going the other way. And I didn't, like, not this year, but last year. It was amazing just how everything come back right in the end at Wisconsin and then the AOI championship on the final day. I had to catch 25 pounds to make the classic, and I was in 43rd, and I had to get back up to 39, and I caught 25.5 that day, the biggest bag I've ever caught a smallmouth, and miraculously jumped 11 spots in the tournament and got those 11 points I needed, and that was a miracle. So
I remember you backstage looking at the leaderboard. And
I said, I don't never want to be here again.
Cutting it a little close.
I felt like you were remarkably calm given given all that was on the line. So that was probably just the public look.
Now, we're talking the last 12 years of the Elite Series, but you had been involved well before that. Let's step back now, and I want to get to that point and talk about the time that you started. But before we get there, you've got an interesting story as a kid when you kind of developed the interest. You had a lot of time on the water, and I think you knew early on what you wanted to do. And I kind of want you to start with that early time in your life when the dream happened, and when you kind of realized that you needed to start doing X, Y, Z to move towards that. So let's step back and talk about that.
Yeah, back in the old days now, as we call it. I'm 44 years old this year, and so I started bass.
Well, Jim thought you were about 50 yesterday. Is that
he might have. No. I was looking at my stats. I feel like it.
I was calculating your kid's age and thinking, okay, where is it?
Yeah.
I thought 40s.
So high school, my mom and dad, I'm an only child, so my mom and dad bought this little fish camp marina business that had actually gone out of business, bankrupt little place, when I was 11 years old in North Carolina on Lake Gaston. And my dad loved to fish. He had fished one Bassmaster back in the 70s, and he really wanted me to get into it. And he thought by getting in this marina business and building up, he could fish more and guide and get into fishing more. And he ended up not being able to fish much ever, because that's like a 7-day, 24-hour-a-day job, seven-day-a-week job. And so he kind of trained me to be a guide, and I started guiding when I was 11 years old. And I'm one of my sons, Oakley, is 12 now, and I can't imagine paying him, $200 to take me fishing if I was lived in New York and I didn't know anything about it. And I went on and called and got him a guide on Lake Gaston, and I show up and this 11 or 12 year old kid's here to take you fishing. That's crazy to me how I used to do that. And my dad, I don't know how my dad ever sold that to people. All I remember, he always said that he'd tell them that if he didn't have a good time, didn't catch fish, you didn't owe him any money. It was free. So that was always the deal, and nobody ever had to get their money back. That's the thing. And so I learned to give people a good time. I learned to deal with people and all personalities at a young age. I grew up fast because I played basketball in high school, but none of my friends fished, so I was like the lone ranger in fishing. Mm-hmm. So I would go 46 miles to school, to a Christian school that I went to, and my mom and dad would drive me back and forth, and I'd go back to the middle of nowhere into this lake and be an adult. And then I'd go to school and be a kid, and I'd be an adult. That's kind of how I feel like I grew up. But I learned a lot. I ran a tackle store, boat rentals, gas pump. I did all that as a teenager in guiding. But my competition, my love for competition in basketball and all that in North Carolina, kind of got me into tournament fishing as a teenager with my dad and then my partners. And I fished Red Man, which is BFL nowadays, fished that when I was 16. And then my dream at that time, all I ever wanted to do was be a bass pro. I didn't know anything else, didn't know what it even meant to be a bass pro. I just knew that my dad especially had always told me, that I'm good enough to do it, I could do it, I could do it. And he pushed me and always made me believe that I could do it. And so I didn't have a plan B. All I had a plan was to be a pro, so that's all I knew. And I didn't go to college because at the time Hardee's, the food chain, was there in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, where I went to school. My Robin got a teaching degree at North Carolina Wesley and all in that town, and the Hardee's Corporation was there, and I guided a lot of those corporate guys on Lake Gaston. So during that period, as a teenager, I talked the president into sponsoring me. So I had Hardee's on the side of my boat. I had the first boat that wasn't a wrap, but it was just a big sticker that said Hardee's Fishing Team when I was 15 years old. And when I come and through high school, he sponsored me, and they gave me, it was like $7,500, and he got some money from Minute Maid and Coca-Cola, and so I was like big time, man. I had some sponsors at 15 years old paying my BFLs, and I got in, and him, I told him I'm gonna go right out of high school into the Bassmaster stuff, and if I qualified to be on the big top 100 tour, would he sponsor me? Then he said, yeah, you just keep doing what you're doing, we'll sponsor you. So I had the backing just from them as well. So I never thought, you know, about going into college because we didn't have college fishing or high school fishing at the time. And luckily went right out and jumped in and did good enough the first year. I think I finished 46 maybe my first year on the Invitational.
What year was that?
Probably 92, 93 okay. maybe. Because we got me and Robin got married. We were high school sweethearts, 15, 16 years old. We got married in 92. We graduated high school in 91. And so we've been married 25 years this year.
Good for you.
Yeah, it's been a blessing.
And good for her.
So she, good for her. Amen. So we grew up together. She liked to fish. We had the same passions, and we grew up and did it all together. And that's what made it work, you know. And I went through the period there the first year. As I was getting into fishing invitationals, I had ulcerative colitis. That was kind of my testimony, my sickness. That disease, inflammatory bowel disease, flared up six months after we got married, and my colon ruptured at a BFL regional in Georgia. And I started throwing up blood and was really sick, made it back to the hospital, went in emergency surgery and stayed in the hospital 2 weeks. And
you'd gotten really dehydrated.
With the three holes had burst in my colon from the from prednisone. They had me on such a strong dose of prednisone, it eat through the lining of my colon. That's what the doctors at Duke ended up saying. So I had an ileostomy bag. I was in the hospital 2 weeks, lost 40 pounds, and then went on that journey of about 3.5 months of two more big surgeries at Duke, which was, you know, God's miracle hand that it all came together, and I was able to get fixed and healed up in time to never miss a tournament, because I had just qualified in the Invitationals to start on the top 100 tour. And now I was looking at this, facing this, hey, it looks like it's not going to happen, because now I'm in the hospital and all that. And so I got all that done, and got the last surgery was February of 93. And I started on the tour, I think it was May of 93, just a couple months after those surgeries. And all these 25 years of doing it almost, I've never missed a tournament, thank God. So that's the cool story of how, you know, the healing and God's provision was what it was meant for me to be here. It's meant for me to do what I'm doing. And I've been able to use that story along with others to be able to have a ministry to speak at churches and wild game dinners. And that's a big part of our passion of what we do. But getting back to it, me and Robin started young. We've done it, and we grew up in the sport. I didn't have, and after the Hardy's deal kind of went away, he retired the first year on the invitation out in the tour. He retired after that, so they didn't have any interest in it. He was just helping me out, and so I get
friends in high places.
Yeah, now I didn't have really any real help, and we were like MasterCard and Visa were our two biggest sponsors. Yeah. They were high interest sponsors.
Yeah,
and so we, you know, that's where people that helped me out along the way. Of course, my mom and dad helped me, and my you know, I had local restaurants, local furniture store guy. I mean, when kids come up to me all the time now, and college kids especially, want to know the shortcut or the easy way all the time to get sponsors, and they always want to look to Triton or to you know, Mercury or to the big Livingstons and the big companies. But I always tell them, you've got to tap out your local area, because you can't do anything for somebody at a national level when you're on a local level. You got to try to get the people in your area involved in what you're doing and take them fishing and do some trade outs and get some local money to get where you need to go before you have value for a bigger company to sponsor you. So that was kind of what I did, not even knowing any better. That's just what I did, because I did everything I could to survive, because I wanted to make it, you know, and it was a struggle, but we did.
You know, Justin Lucas was in here a couple weeks ago, and this is something that he said that has stuck with me, and it's something I think I really believe in what he said, and I want to hear your take on it. He said, you know, a lot of people are worried about getting sponsors today, and they're not spending enough time worrying about the fish. And you talk about all that, and I know that you knew how to fish, knew how to catch bass, but how important is that level of on-the-water education and being proficient with a rod and reel in your hand, as opposed to getting somebody to give you a bunch of money at first?
Yeah, at first, that's 100% accurate. You've got to have the game. You've got to have the confidence. And you can't get confidence without being on the water and getting the experience. And that's why young guys that come out that are really good anglers, you know, and you get on the Elite Series the first year and they get overwhelmed sometimes. They get out there and they're so worried about the money, because it is expensive, that they're doing everything they can to try to get the sponsors, and they quit fishing a little bit and they start doing everything else. And then before you know it, you have a bad tournament or two, and confidence and everything else not being there, you spiral out of control and have a bad year. And it's nothing that you're not a good enough fisherman. You're still the same great angler, but confidence is still, I say that every day, confidence, confidence, confidence. And that's why I think Kevin Van Dam has been the best of all time, because he's got so much confidence and he's always had confidence. Mm-hmm. And confidence is something I've struggled with over my career, because it can be day to day, you know, and your circumstances can determine your confidence level. Mm-hmm. And that's what you got to get better at.
What
and I've learned.
What do you do to build your confidence? Because I think some people, maybe it's Kevin, naturally has it.
It is, no doubt.
But I think for probably the majority of people, it's something that if you do the right things, whether that be the preparation, whether that be in your lifestyle, what to you is kind of your keys to being confident, to building confidence?
Yeah, it's definitely a DNA on some people that are wired with confidence, and that's always, I think, a head start person. So in this business, in this sport, if you can get your talent to match up with your confidence, you can excel quickly. But if not, you got to build your confidence through a process, and like almost like Nick Saban in Alabama football says, it's a process. It's a bad subject right now for Alabama fan. But the process of doing the right things every day and making it a habit, you know, you know, working hard, doing your research online, doing everything you can to get the information you need and all the tools you need, all your equipment. And my confidence comes a lot in preparation and details. And I'm a big detailist, and you know, having your every little detail on your boat, and your in from the outside all the way into the inside, all the way down to the hook box, and the hooks lined up right, all the best hooks, the best line, the best knot, all the things you can control with your rod and reels, your drag, everything, knowing it inside and out. And that gives me confidence when I'm on the water now, that now it's just me and the fish. I've just got to figure out what they want to bite, where they're going to be, and then putting together just something that I can run with and build off of. And the more you catch fish on a whim, you know, one here, one there, the more you feel like I can do that everywhere I go, and that confidence builds it and builds it. But like I said, circumstantial confidence sometimes is a problem, because you have a bad day or two, you know, and you don't catch anything one day, and that happens to everybody. I mean, almost every year it happens to everybody. One day or another, you're going to have a day that you don't catch anything, or you catch one or two fish. And those are the days that I feel I can still, after 25 years, I can still feel like, man, I don't know what I'm doing. How have I made a living this long doing this? I can't even catch a bass.
Just get the man a bobber and a worm.
That's
right?
What it feels like. But that's the days you got to just let it roll off like a water off a duck's back, and just know that, hey, put that day behind me. I feel good. I don't know tomorrow I'm not going to do anything I did today. So I'm excited about tomorrow now, because I know I've got a lot of new ideas for tomorrow, that something's going to work.
So I've learned, even as I've aged, I know I'm the junior here in this company. However, yeah, a little bit. I've learned that I got to have a routine to kind of keep up on all of the stuff I've got going, to keep all the balls I've got in the air, and, you know, stuff like that. So tell me about your daily routine. How do you, when you're at an event, talk to me about your maybe hour by hour, but what do you do to keep yourself focused and keep your confidence up with your gear management and prepping to get on the water in the morning?
Yeah, routine for me has been really helpful. And you'd probably see, like you said, the last 12 years or 13 years that I've had the high success, because I think it's a lot to do with family and camping, you know. And I've started, me and Robin, for 9 years we were married, and we struggled doing this business before we had kids, before we finally started making a living. We didn't camp. We stayed in motels, and we did all that, and then all of a sudden we realized the camping world was a big deal, and we got a motor home, and then we progressed throughout the years, you know, with campers and fifth wheels and camping world. I got a sponsorship with Camping World to help us get campers every couple of years, and having that routine where Robin's homeschooling our boys, so I've got my family with me on the road, and I've got my campers like my house, you know, I've got all my tackle like my tackle store underneath the storage, and I've got everything there with me, so I don't have any feeling of guilt or disappointment or lack, and that helps build my confidence of preparation, because I know I'm prepared on the inside before I get on the water. And that's how, and my routine is, you know, I keep my boat right there at my camper. My stuff's ready. I over prepare, you know, the night of the event, for the meeting night. I go back and I'll, you know, the only person that ever stays out in their boat later at night to me is Aaron Martins, typically, and I see him over there.
He's
hardcore. I mean, camping, and he's up 12, 1 o'clock in the morning on that night. And I am some nights, but I just frustrate myself on those nights because I'm ready to go to bed, but I can't let myself go when I know there's a possibility of needing one more bait in my mind that I don't want to have to dig out tomorrow, so I'll go ahead and rig it down. I have 25, 26 Daiwa, you know, elite rods sitting in the rod locker, rigged and ready to go. And so that's my preparation. And I get up, take a shower. You know, I'm one of the last guys in the routine to the ramp.
I've seen you and Aaron come in together most of the time.
me and Aaron. It's funny. It's me and Aaron and Chris Lane. And let's see, who else? There's always one or two out there with me. We're like the last five or six guys. We all kind of get there at the end. I do it on purpose because I don't like to get to the ramp and wait in line. I'm an antsy, anxious person. So when I roll up to the ramp and I see a line and I can't see the end of it, I start worrying and getting nervous if I'm going to make it up there in time, even though it will because it's going to move. But I don't think that when I see it. So if I wait and let everybody get out of the way, because I don't have to get a park because my wife puts me in and she drives back to the campground. So all I got to do is get there and launch and I'm ready to go. And I don't like sitting around and talking to doc talk and hearing stories of what everybody else is doing. I want to do my own thing and stay focused on what I'm doing. And this other deal with me too, after I've had all these surgeries, so I don't have any colon. So I mean, I have an issue. I have to go to the bathroom, you know, 12 to 15 times in a 24-hour period. So I'm trying to, I have to take medicine every morning to keep myself good to go all day on the water, so I don't, you know, if I wait to the last minute and go to the bathroom the last minute and then we're done hopefully for the day. And
that sounds like about everybody's ritual before they go fishing in the morning though.
Yeah, so
sounds like you know your tendencies and you manage them, and that seems like something you have to really be honest with yourself about.
It is.
And having to take advantage of the steps that you set forth so you can stick
to
it.
Little OCD. I'm not hardcore OCD, but I think everybody that is successful at something, whatever that is, I think has a little bit of that in, because you got to have that to be, because I see so many great anglers, even right now in our sport, that are young guys that I see so much talent and potential in them, but you see, I look at them and think, if they only would work on this part, they would be a superstar, and you see them not.
Is there anybody that you'd say is more OCD on the tour than you?
Oh yeah, definitely Aaron. Again, Aaron's the most of all, but he's one of the most successful, one of the best ever, and it has a lot to do with it. He drives himself crazy, I know, because he tells me. But that is what's made him so successful and so great, and so, like you say, managing that's what I try to do. And after doing it for so long, I've seen the last 3 or 4 years where I've never had a burnout feeling in the sport, but I have the last 3 or 4 years in a row. By the end of the season, I'm getting that feeling of burnout where I sometimes I even dread preparation because that's what wears me out is preparation, because mentally I drain myself trying to think of so much and prepare and over prepare and then overthink, and that's the part that wears me out. The fishing on the water, that part I don't get burnt out on, but the preparation I get burnt out on. So when I get done with the AOI championship, man, I don't feel like I want to fish again for a while, and I hate that sometimes because my boys love fishing, and I like to still take them and do stuff, and they're getting into high school fishing big, and so I'm having to stay in it more for their sake, but at the same time I'm not really getting into the fishing, you know, mental side of it as much. It's kind of more them and not me.
So you mentioned you said you started in 92 as a trying to make a living at it, so that puts you at 25 years
of
doing this, which is a phenomenal success story.
Is there somebody, so think back that far into where you're at now, is there somebody along the way that kind of helped you get a hold of the management side of things? I'm sure probably Robin was key in keeping you organized, but
for sure.
Where was that point where you realized you had to turn all of this stress that comes with this job, with this career, into a management style? Was there a person or someone that taught you that? How'd you figure that out?
You know, that's a good question, and it's a hard one, because I never really had that, you know, happen. I really, my big, probably my biggest break where where it turned around was 1996. I came to Trustful, Alabama, Birmingham area, living in North Carolina, and I came with Terry Chupp. We had a chaplain on tour named Terry Chupp that was our bash chaplain, and I came to speak at an event called a Team Jesus Tournament on Logan Martin Lake in Southern Comfort Conversions. We're here in Trustful with MCM Conversions. They had a tournament there, and I came and be a part of it to help out with Terry. And at that event, I spoke and talked and helped out. And at the end of that event, Rod McSweeney, who owned that company, he was in bass fishing and sponsoring fishermen. At the time, he had Ron Shuffield and Ray Sedgwick and some guys driving conversion vans. And Guy Aker. Guy Aker was his main guy. And Rod come up to me and said, I see potential in you. I believe in you. Something just tells me I want to sponsor you and help you. And so he said, I'm going to give you a conversion van to drive and put you on our Southern Comfort Anglers team. He said, and Earl Bentz here. And Earl Bentz was there. And Earl came up. He introduced me to Earl, said, Earl Bentz here is our good friend and partner. And Earl wants to give you a new Triton boat. He's getting ready to start Triton Boat Company. And that was the year Triton was building to start in 97. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I'm going to have to pray about it. Okay, I'll take it. You know, that was my deal. And it was really funny. And so when Rod believed in me and Earl Bentz believed in me, they gave me my first break. They gave me my first real sponsorship of a van and a boat. And that was just huge for me because we were at the point of credit card was just where we were just – it was like – that was like the – point of it getting really tight, and we needed a break, and that was the break I needed. So that year, once he gave me that, I finished ninth that year in the end of year points when I was 22 years old, 23, and I made the Classic at 23 years old, 1997 Classic in Birmingham. Okay.
Yeah, and your first Classic.
First Classic at 97, and I was 23 years old. I was the youngest one that year in the Classic, and ironically, you know, who would ever thought that 17 years later I would win the Classic on that same stage in Birmingham, Alabama. How cool was that? You know, never would have thought that. You looking ahead 17 years, I was thinking I was going to win the Classic that year, the next year, the next year.
Every year.
And like 17 years later, it took that long before it finally happened. But on the same place in Birmingham, that's what's so cool.
This is one of my favorite stories, and I bring this up. I knew we were going to talk about this, but I was talking to somebody. I'm trying to remember who it was. It was a pro in the last couple weeks that was talking about the Guntersville Classic in 2014. And somebody had said, you know, I was on the right fish. I was there. You know, I would have had it. But then Randy turned his boat around and the whole thing changed. And that's kind of been a joke I've heard a few times. And this is a great story. And I want you to tell that about – and maybe people don't really know. You know, you can look back and remember the Classic champions over the year and different years. You know, Edwin Evers having that monster day, which I know is another source of it for you. But, you know, still, Edwin turned his boat around that day.
He sure did.
But I want you to tell that story about your Classic victory on Guntersville. And it is a cool correlation between your first Classic – in Birmingham to that one, and I hope we go back one day because it's been a while. It feels like,
but 50th anniversary is coming. Boys.
We need to think that way.
A couple of years.
Yeah.
So give me the story about you turning your boat around in 2014.
So it was day three.
Day three. Yeah. Day two. You know, and I'm in 11th place, 9.5 pounds out. All the pressure is off now. I made the cut to fish the final day, so I've got all the King's Home kids. You know, everybody in Bass had helped get the place for 100 kids to sit in the arena, so I was going to be there to fish that day. So that was my goal at the point. It was just making sure I could be there because that deal was happening. Mm-hmm. And so that morning, I'm putting the boat in, and me and my wife always say a little prayer, and a friend of mine was there with us, and my wife said, just go out there and have fun today. Don't stress. All the worry, the stress is over. Just go out there and have fun and just listen to your gut. Listen to the Holy Spirit, so that, you know, and how we believe, you know, my faith. And so when I'm getting ready to take off, I've already told them that I'm going to Mill Creek. You know, so they're going up there to watch me, and Livingston had some camera guys that were going to take some pictures up there of me. And so everybody was gone there, and I'm running there that morning, and I believe 100% that all this didn't happen. The good Lord was in control of it all, and it happened in 2014 because that was the first year we had technology to cover it and put it on, you know, to record it with the GoPro on the windshield.
We had the GoPro. First classic we had.
That's
GoPro
right.
In
GoPro
the boat.
In the boat.
And
so
that saved our bacon.
It did.
Because
it did.
We didn't have a photographer on.
Because
you.
Nobody expects anybody to happen. You know, when you got 10 great anglers on a lake as good as Guntersville, you expect somebody out of 10 to just catch a big bag in that group and win. And so that's what I thought. So I'm running, and I mean, I got, like I said, in the Livingston commercial and on the stage, the overwhelming urge to turn around, and I was halfway, you know, down, you know, halfway going up the lake, and just, I mean, it just hit me like a voice, like strong, said, turn around now and go to Spring Creek Bridge. And I could see like a video popping up in my mind, and I could see myself standing under that bridge. It was an eerie moment, man, seeing myself standing there, and I'm catching fish, and I see it in my mind. So I knew what it was, and I fought it for a second. I said, man, well, Lord, I know it's the Lord telling me this. I know it is, but I'm like, well, I've already told everybody I'm going to Mill Creek, so I don't want to be a liar, you know, to mess with my own family's up here waiting on me. And then it said, do you want to be good or you want to be great? And that was the first time I'd ever heard anything like that. So I knew it was something special, and I needed to listen and do it. So that's when I turned around, and the GoPro documented that whole turnaround. To build that story, so people know when I tell that story, that's really what happened.
Yeah.
And so I had no intention of going and doing that until that very moment, because I had fished at that bridge two times the first day and two times the second day, hadn't caught anything until the second day. I caught a few short fish there, and I wasn't intending to go there. And so when I turned and got there to that bridge,
what time did you get there?
I mean, 10, you know, probably 8 or 9 minutes after takeoff.
Okay.
I mean, I don't really remember what time it was we took off, but all I remember, it was a Sunday morning. It was the warmest day we had had all year. It was like 65 degrees that morning and overnight. And right as I'm getting to the bridge, nobody's fishing on the bank, which was a miracle because it was Sunday morning. There's usually 10 crappie fishermen there. Mm-hmm. Nobody was there on a boat or on the bank yet. There were some guys walking down, but I got there right before that. And Aaron Martins was sitting there. He stood up. He stopped in front of me. He stood up, and I saw him look back and forth at the water. And he looked and saw me coming, and he jumped down and took off. And I think he told me later he thought I was trying to get to the back of the creek where he was going. So he left. So when I put my trolling motor down, his backwash was still spinning under the bridge. And my first cast, I catch a 3-pounder, second cast, then his third cast, I catch a 7-pounder. Mm. And when I caught that 7-pounder, I knew that everything that was happening was happening for a reason, and that's where I was supposed to be. But I still never thought that I'm here to win the Classic today. I never thought that at all. And in just a short amount of time, I'd caught 80-some pounds of fish on the bass track, my marshal told me. And so the third or fourth fish, a guy starts watching me. It's a guy I knew from out of state that was there. And I told him to call my wife and tell him to come down there to this bridge because I was here and not there. So they all showed up, and little by little on 431, people were seeing the action, and they were lining up like a golf gallery along the railing of the bridge.
Which is right against the road, by the way.
Let me tell you my piece of that.
Okay.
So that morning, I was at takeoff with our .com crew. We did the things we needed to do, and then myself and Steve Bowman and I think Dave Mercer hopped in a truck, and we're going to head back to Birmingham. It was probably an hour after launch.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to make that turnoff right before you get to the Spring Creek Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And head west.
79,
kind of like the way you came to Birmingham today. So from that turnoff, we look down there at the bridge and see a massive crowd.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like the whole bridge is lined with people.
I know.
And I remember a school bus, and it was probably, I don't know if it was a school bus transporting people to the takeoff, or whether it was a church bus, you know, mm-hmm. getting people to church kind of thing. But it was pulled up with people looking out the window of that bus watching you fish. So we, instead of turning, we said, let's go see what's going on down there. And we get down there, and there's probably, in my mind, there was 100 people on that bridge.
Easily.
watching you fish at 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we're like, something's going on here. We got to look at him in Bass Track. And
And at the time, and I was leading, and I didn't even know it. That was the crazy thing, you know. After the whole day, and having the greatest day ever, I still never tensed up or never thought, well, man, I need one more fish to win the Bassmaster Classic, or I never thought that, you know. I never knew until I got in the truck that day to drive back to Birmingham, and I asked my wife, what's the Bass Track say? Because, you know, we can't access Bass Track ourselves and into competition time. So Robin said, you really want to know? And I was trying to eat my bologna sandwich. I'll never forget it, because I hadn't eaten. I was starving, and I was starting to eat my sandwich, and she said, you really want to know? I said, yeah. She said, well, you've been leading all day. And I said, are you serious? Am I still leading right now? And she said, well, yeah, they've got you in the lead right now. And instantly I got dry mouth. I couldn't swallow my sandwich. I mean, started crying. I mean, I was like, it was a mess. It was the biggest emotional wreck driving to Birmingham, because trying to not let yourself get too high and think, yeah, I'm going to win. And then, because somebody always jerks the rug out from under you, and fishing at the last minute, the last guy or something. So I didn't want to believe it. But at the same time, I would think, well, why did all this crazy stuff happen today? And then it not finish out right. Why not? Why could it not be that way?
Didn't you catch a last minute fish? This is one of my favorite parts of this story. And this was the whole something was happening. Yeah. You were being led down a path, and you had that great day under the bridge, but then you had to make a move.
Yeah, and this was the part that I tell that you didn't see on TV, and this was a part. I'm going down the riprap, and it was 12. I never forget. I look down at my Lowrance, and it's 12-14, and I catch a first good one I caught in a little while, and it was like a 4 3/4 pound or so, balance beaming, and throw one back, a big one back, and I stand up to make a cast, and it, that same voice, same feeling again, said, go to the back of the creek right now. And I said, and I saw myself, just like that video again, I saw myself throwing a bladed jig, chatterbait type bait. I could see me doing it. And I said, oh, man, Lord, I can't leave here. There's too many fish biting here. This can't be, I don't know what, why am I thinking this? And I was battling my mind again, and I looked back at the camera guy, and it was a guy that was a golf photographer. ESPN brought him. He wasn't a fisherman guy. I looked at him, I'll never forget, and I tell this story at churches all the time. I said, hey, jump down real quick and get ready. We're going to run to the back of the creek. And he looked out of his camera. He said, dude, I'm not a fisherman, but, you know, and I don't film a lot of fishing, but are you sure you want to leave here? he said, I thought the point of this deal is you're trying to catch fish, and hey, you've caught fish all day since I've been here. And I said, man, just sit down, let's go. Don't talk me out of it. So I run to the back of the creek, and now there's like 40 or 50 boats sitting around watching. They weren't expecting, so they all jumped down because they don't like, where is he going? You know, he's got to be nuts because I were catching so many fish. And I run 2 miles back there in the back of Spring Creek, where I live now, and it was so muddy from the mud from that rain 2 nights before. It looked like you could walk on it. It was so muddy. And I immediately, my natural mind said, man, mistake, what are you doing? You should have never left. Now I'm thinking somebody's going to be at the bridge and took it back over, and I'm not going to get back. So all these negative thoughts are flying. And I stand up, and I pick up, and I mean, third or fourth cast, and crack, you know, and I catch a 6 1/4. And so I look at the camera, and I said, that's what we come back here for, right here. That's what we come back here for.
So you culled up with that
fish. And so when I put the balance beam there, I had a hard time throwing a fish back, because I kept thinking I was making a mistake. Right as I'd about to throw this one back, I'd think, oh, I'd put them back in a live well, and I'd get them out, look again, make sure. And finally, I realized this was I got my scale, and it was like a 5'3", 5'4" fish, and it was the smallest one. I threw it back, and I traded it for about a 6'4", and I won by 1 pound. So that was the real story. If that hadn't happened, I could have just had a great day at the bridge and probably finished second or third or fourth, and we wouldn't be here talking about it right now.
Thomas,
that's why it was a miracle.
I got a question for you. So who finished second in that classic? I think I know, but
Paul Mueller.
Paul Mueller, yeah, the Connecticut cat.
It was Paul Mueller.
That's right.
Who was fishing as the nation champion.
And had the biggest
32 pounds
limit in record, classic history.
On day two?
Day two.
I could see his face when you said that.
Let me tell you how I remember him, and I know him well now. He's an awesome guy, and he's on the Elite Series now, but I know him because I walked through to come out to sit on the hot seat, and Davey Height was back there, and I said, Davey, please tell me, do I have a chance to win today? Because I knew he had talked to everybody, and he said, well, if you can make it past Paul Mueller, you might have a chance. And I said, who's Paul Mueller? And he said, he's a guy that had 32 pounds yesterday. I said, oh, God, that's Paul Mueller. So when I got out there, and when Paul Mueller rolled around, I'm in the hot seat, and they said, and Mercer said, Paul Mueller had 32 pounds yesterday. He needs 25 pounds, something, something, whatever ounces And when they were putting, when he got that bag out and sat it up there, and Tripp had that GoPro like on his chest, mm-hmm. and you could yeah. see the fish, and every one of them looked like 10 pounders in his basket. And when he said 24 pounds, and Mercer turned and looked in his eyes, I could still see his big eyes looking at me like, it's almost like he said, you just won, because he knew, I think, that if Mueller, they thought Mueller, because Robin was yeah. sitting in the crowd, and you know, Mike Malone and some people had already come up to Robin, and they were kind of getting her ready to bring her up there to the stage, and Robin said at the last few minutes, they were on the phone, and everybody left her and went to Paul Mueller's wife. And then she thought, oh, God, here goes the moment that the rug gets jerked out, because we've been here so long. We've seen it all, so we know yeah. that now they're not standing there with Robin. So she's thinking, oh, well, let down again, you know. And then as soon as he didn't have enough, they walked back down to Robin again. It's time to bring her down here now. So
talk about cool. that moment. That was one of my favorites. I've been able to be at the Classics since the 2010 Lay Lake, even before I worked for Bass. That moment is so special as a fan, as a family member of an angler. I'm sure it's intense. And for you, that moment when they called the weight that gave you the chance to hold that trophy up. Yeah. I want to know what went through your mind.
Yeah, that last minute, you know, because Edwin had been leading, so Edwin had to be the last one to weigh in and in the line and Super 6. So when he got his fish up there, I was still worried about him because he's always been light on his bass track and 4 or 5 pounds light a lot of times. And sure enough, that day his bass track said 14 and he had 18, almost 19 or whatever. But I knew when he put them down there and I saw it and they read the weight off and boom, it was like, that's the moment, is like the movie where everything kind of goes silent in your mind. You're hearing the
slow motion.
Yeah, like slow motion. You're hearing the roar and all the intensity, but it kind of gets like a fade, almost like you're blacking out a little bit.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was up above looking down in the crowd. It was weird, man. And I mean, I could feel it.
Remind us of your weight that day.
It was 29 pounds, 2 ounces.
Okay.
You know, and it was the record at the day. And then when Edwin won at Oklahoma, he had 29.3.
Yes.
And broke that record by
yes.
an ounce that day. So, and it was ironic because he, you know, he was the one leading then, and then I won. And then the other time at Oklahoma, when I felt like I was going to win that, and he did kind of the same thing I did, and he
yeah.
won. So we talked about that. It was ironic. But anyway, that was the kind of the moment it all happened and how it all went down, and it still was surreal and just a feeling. And like I said, I tell everybody all the time when I tell that story, even if it hadn't have been me that day, if that had happened to anybody else, it would be just as special to me, because like as a fan of the sport, you want the best drama and you want the best Cinderella story to win the world championship, like the Bassmaster mm-hmm. Classic. You want it to mean something to somebody when it happens. And when it all played out like that, I still feel like, even though not just because it was me again, but I still feel like it's one of the greatest classics ever because the way it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was an exciting one. That's one that stands out in my mind quite a bit. And one of my favorite championship stories, and there's a lot of great stories. That's the great thing about this sport, is we have a lot of mm-hmm. come-from-behind victories and people making their dreams come true. And that was one that took you 20 years
mm-hmm.
to get to. And,
yeah.
and that's really something that, you know, that adds up. You know, guys that come in, and it's not that Jordan Lee doesn't appreciate it.
Yeah.
But you had so many ups and downs to
yeah.
get to where you're at, that it really, when it all, you know, hit the apex there for you during
yeah.
that tournament, that had to have been just... I mean, you're due to win another one, Randy, but it's going to be hard to beat that.
Yeah, it was just right, and I'm going to say I hope I win 10 more, but none of them I don't think could ever be as special as that one because of the way it all played out and the way I got set up, so to speak. You know, I still feel like it was such a divine intervention. It was a setup for a greater purpose, for a testimony, really is what it's all about.
Yeah. Hey, so you won it on Gunnersville. You now live in Gunnersville. Is the next step running for mayor up there?
No, we got a really good mayor up there.
You're pretty busy. I don't know if you got time for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Miss Lee, we got a lady mayor that's super yeah. sweet, and she's smart and
sharp.
She
was the mayor during that class?
Yeah, and she runs the town really good. And our dream, we had really always wanted to live in Gunnersville. And before I won the Classic, we'd always said one day when the boys get older, go to college and maybe leave home, we thought it might be up in our 50s one day, mid-50s, we might could get to move up there. But then after winning that and meeting the mayor and all the people in town and kind of getting to know a lot more about the area. And then, you know, Boyd Duckett had a development up there that he was developing. He was trying to get started in that area. And he you know, I started inquiring about moving and getting a lot. And Boyd really helped me with a good deal on a lot. And it all kind of came together, yeah.
That lot kind of overlooks the bridge area,
I can see the back of the creek where I caught that last fish. I can see where I caught that fish from my dock. Mm-hmm. And then I go across the bridge multiple times a day when I'm in town, though. And every time I go across that bridge, I say thank you, Lord, every time I ride over it. And I think it day and night, there's somebody fishing there all the time.
you kind of turn that pattern on its head. Everybody doesn't know.
I looked at one other stat for you, Randy. So you have fished in, let me get these numbers straight, 271 Bassmaster tournaments.
Wow, 271. Right. Feels like more than that.
271 Bassmaster tournaments.
Well, you can multiply that by about three or four, and that's how many days of tournament fishing level. That's a lot.
And out of that, you've been in the money 168 times.
What's that percent?
The percent is 61%.
That's
you're
strong.
In the money, 61%. Now, in baseball terms, you're batting 600.
Yeah, that sounds better in baseball terms, then. Let's talk baseball terms.
You know, 61% of the time, that's strong. I mean, that is strong.
And it's so hard.
Particularly when you're talking, actually, this is the 12 years of the Elite Series.
Mm-hmm.
No, it didn't. That's everything.
No, that was everything.
That's everything. So, that's a long career, and you know it's not two good years. That's
it's so hard to judge our sport, because other sports, if you're not winning, you're nothing. If you're not a winner, and that's what's so hard about people that don't follow the sport, and you think, well, I didn't win. How many tournaments you win this year? Well, I didn't win any this year. Oh, you suck. You know what happened? You know, but I didn't win one this year or last year. But I made the Classic. That's our big deal. But people that don't follow sport, they don't realize that. But so we want to be better, and you want to win, and that's always my goal every day or year. I want to win Angler of the Year, and I want to win the Classic. But it just can't always happen. So if you can, the next best thing to that is getting a check and being consistent and making a Classic, and that's how you make your living with sponsors and endorsements and things like that. And that's what I'm thankful for.
There's a lot to your story, and I know that we're going to see a lot more develop because you're a long ways from being done. But one of the things I like to wrap these shows up with is to talk a little bit about the next generation. You spend a lot of time on the road. Your boys are growing up. They're fishing. You talk to a lot of men's groups and church organizations, and your faith is deeply rooted in all of this. And take a minute to address the youth that are entering the high school arena. They're getting into college fishing. And granted, you know, Matt Herron was in here a couple weeks ago, and I joked with him. I said, you know, think about the days you fished before you had electronics, and you had to learn fishing the hard way. I want you to give a message out to the youth, to the kids, and say, if you want to get to this level, you need to think about XYZ.
Yeah, it's such an amazing plan now in place to be a professional bass fisherman. It's more exciting than it's ever been, and it's a lot to do with the, you know, Bassmaster helping build Bassmaster High School fishing, Bassmaster College fishing, and now there's a path. We never had a path to tell people before. I always try to encourage kids before Bassmaster High School and College started, but it's hard to encourage them without a roadmap. But now you've got a roadmap, and in my Laker's 16, he's fishing for Gunnersville High School. I'm boat captain, and I'm emceeing the Bassmaster High School events in Alabama just because I enjoy being a part of it and doing it while I'm there. But now there's a roadmap that my son knows now that, look, if you want to try to do what I'm doing, you fish the high school stuff, you learn the ropes, you go right into college, you fish it in college, you get your education, and then if it's meant to be a pro, you've got the guidelines laid out, and if you've got the talent and the perseverance and everything happens right, you can come out and be what Jordan Lee and Matt Lee and a lot of other ones have done. But if not, you've got the education. You've got to have the education side of it to make it in fishing or anything else now. So that's what I tell the kids now. Fish hard. Learn all you can. Get as much experience. Don't worry about sponsorships. Just try to fish and get better at fishing. That's the main thing. And then follow the roadmap for bass.
You know, the business side of bass fishing is not something that just anybody can figure out. It takes a lot of education, a lot of getting baptized by fire, if you will. And, you know, again, talk about that sentiment real quick that Justin Lucas mentioned here. You need to learn the fish. Get to know the fish. Build the passion for fishing.
Yeah.
And then let things fall in place.
That's right. I'd say it when I speak to the kids groups a lot. The rule of five, I kind of made that term up. Learn to catch five bass every day. Mm-hmm. First thing you need to do, go out there and get better at fishing every bait, every technique, depths. You know, we especially living in Alabama, you've got so many great lakes to go fish on. But learn diversity and lures and learn how to catch five bass every day, mm-hmm. and put yourself in a pressure situation when you go out every day and compete with yourself or your buddy. Try to catch five. And when you get good at doing that, that's when you start doing better in tournaments and getting tournament experience. Don't even worry about a sponsorship until you can do that first.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to have to put fish on the scales to impress somebody to want to put money behind you. But, look, this has been fun. It's like every time we do one of these, it gets a little better every time.
I enjoyed it. It went by fast,
too. It did. Well, we burned over an hour.
I know. That's amazing.
If you're listening to this, we thank you for your support. Appreciate it greatly. Make sure you pass on the show and encourage everyone that you know, grandma, grandpa, the entire family, to subscribe to Inside Bassmaster. But from Jim Sexton, the man at Master Control, Randy Howell, 2014 Bassmaster Classic champion, this has been Thomas Allen, and you've listened to Inside Bassmaster, and we'll catch you here next time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randy. I stumbled in the